three little girls, one loving father, one quiet Washington neighborhood, and then nothing but silence. He didn't vanish. He disappeared on purpose, leaving behind cassette lullabies, hidden offshore accounts, and a manifesto titled Shadows of Justice. I've covered a lot of sinister cases, but this one haunts me. My name is Marissa Lane. I'm a true crime journalist. And for the last 14 months, I've been unraveling secrets no parent should ever keep, and no child should ever die for. Follow me through crime scene investigations, unsettling narratives, and a disturbing trail of financial crimes and chilling details, all leading back to one man, Travis Decker. He didn't just break the law. He built a whole philosophy around murder. If you think justice is a straight line, this story will shatter that illusion. Subscribe now to Shadows of Justice, the Travis Decker Manhunt, a gripping narrative based on true stories, hidden killers, and the chilling secrets left behind. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. I've covered murders before, but never like this. Not in a neighborhood like this. Not with children this young. And definitely not with a father this precise. It was late March when I first heard the name Travis Decker. A newsroom alert flashed across my phone, just after dawn. Spokane police investigating triple homicide. Possible suspect at large. Three minor victims. I was in my bathrobe, coffee still cooling on the windowsill. I remember because I spilled it down my front when I read the line that followed. Father of victims currently missing. That word, missing, it felt too neat. Too sanitized. Missing implies an accident. A wrong turn. This didn't feel accidental. It felt planned. Chillingly so. By noon, I was on a flight. 2 hours later, driving through a sleepy cul-de-sac off Larch Street. And then there it was. The Decker home. Pale blue siding, sagging porch swing, white lace curtains in every window. A child's bike toppled sideways in the driveway. The scene would have passed for serene, if not for the yellow police tape strangling the front porch. It was what you'd call a quiet house. The kind that doesn't speak until it has to. I parked half a block down and walked. Every step felt like trespassing into grief. Neighbors gathered silently in clusters, arms folded, lips tight. A woman in curlers whispered behind her hand. A retired Marine stared at the sky like it might offer answers. But no one really knew what to say. Not yet. They didn't know what had happened inside. But I did. The source I met with, an off-the-record officer who owed me a favor, slipped me the unfiltered version. His hands trembled when he said it. He drugged them first. Each of them. Sedatives. No struggle. No screams. Then what? I asked. He recorded something. Tapes. Each daughter got one. He played the recordings in their ears. Whispered lullabies. Then he smothered them. All of them. Yes. On the same night. Same bed. Same blanket. He waited until they were asleep, then. He couldn't finish. Later, I learned the details. Their names: Hannah. Leah. Grace. Ages 4, 6, and 9. Found tucked in side by side, arms laced like dolls, eyes closed. Peaceful. Deceitfully peaceful. Upstairs still smelled like baby powder and Play-Doh. Their pink backpacks lined up like a goodbye ceremony. An unfinished breakfast bowl sat on the table. Cheerios gone soggy. But it was the basement that silenced me. I descended slowly. One step. Two. Three. My hand grazed the cold concrete wall. Then I heard it, faint looped mechanical. A cassette player. Still running. A lullaby. Just a melody, soft, haunting. Not a nursery rhyme. No lyrics. Just a gentle piano progression, with the static hiss of analog decay. Later I'd identify the melody as Clair de Lune. The track clicked off after a few minutes. Then silence. Real silence. And the silence somehow was worse. This was no rage killing. This was ritual. Back upstairs, I found the piano studio. Travis taught music part-time, out of the rear extension of the house. It was modest but elegant. Mahogany upright, cream-colored rug, stacks of sheet music arranged with clinical precision. But one thing stood out. Above the piano was a hand-painted plaque. In harmony we find order. I stared at that quote until the air in the room felt toxic. Behind a stack of Beethoven sonatas, I found the first cassette. Label: Lullaby No. 3 for Grace. Date: 2 weeks before the murders. He planned this, rehearsed it, wrote lullabies for each child, dated and cataloged. This wasn't a breakdown. It was a belief system. I left the house shaking. I didn't speak for the rest of the day. That night in my motel, I sat in the dark with the tape recorder, forcing myself to listen to Grace's lullaby. I took notes, wrote everything I felt, everything I heard. The tape ended with a whisper. His whisper. I love you more than they'll ever understand. Daddy's going to fix everything. That's when I realized I wasn't chasing a fugitive. I was chasing a ghost. A ghost with a manifesto. A ghost with a plan. And judging by the $140,000 transfer to an offshore account 2 days before the murders, a ghost who may never have intended to be caught. The police were stuck in red tape. Cross-agency conflict. Jurisdictional bureaucracy. The U.S. Marshals hadn't joined the case yet. The media was calling it a family tragedy. But I knew better. This wasn't a tragedy. This was a blueprint. One that Travis Decker designed to look invisible. But ghosts leave fingerprints. And I was going to find them. Everyone wants to believe they know the people closest to them. But sometimes, the most carefully curated lives are just stage sets. And Travis Decker had built a masterpiece. In the days after the murders, I interviewed 15 people who knew Travis, or thought they did. Friends, neighbors, coworkers, former piano students. And every one of them painted a version of the same man. Quiet, gentle, brilliant. A single father trying to do right by his daughters after his wife, Eleanor, left 2 years earlier. She'd filed for divorce after what she described in court documents as emotional indifference and financial secrecy. But even then, no one believed he was dangerous. Just distant. His ex-boss at the CPA firm told me he was methodical to a fault. Said Travis was the guy you handed the ugliest spreadsheet to, and he'd bring it back color-coded, reconciled, and whisper clean. He also said Travis had a habit of staying late, alone, after everyone left. Said he would hum Debussy while balancing account ledgers. I began compiling a timeline. A true crime story told through receipts, emails, surveillance timestamps, and chilling narrative fragments. A crime narrative built with surgical precision. The week before the murders, Travis cashed in his retirement fund, $48,000. Then he liquidated a college account set up for his eldest daughter, another $36,000. Then, two wire transfers. One to a Swiss account, one to a Panamanian holding company called Carver's Estate. My skin went cold. I'd heard that name before. Carver's Estate was a known player in financial corruption and offshore account shielding. I'd seen it in stories involving laundering, arms dealings, and shell company fraud, but never in a suburban family killing. Travis had prepared for escape like a man fleeing not just the law, but the very idea of society. I started referring to this stage of the case as the emptying. He didn't just vanish. He deleted himself. Back in Spokane, I tracked down one of his former piano students, Eva, now 23. She remembered him vividly. He was odd. Not creepy. Just quiet. Always quoting things. Like he'd say stuff like, the law bends to the rhythm of money, and I'd think, okay, weird flex, but cool. She paused. But there was one time, maybe a year before the girls died, he stopped in the middle of a song and stared at the wall. For like a full minute. Then he looked at me and said, chaos is the child of beauty. She never forgot that. Neither did I. Later, I found a paper he once submitted for a music composition course online. It was titled, Harmony vs. Authority: The Case for Structured Rebellion in Modern Music. It wasn't about music. Not really. It was about control. It was about power. And it was full of buried anger. The more I dug, the more it felt like Travis had been building this facade, this image of the perfect father, for years. But behind the tax returns, recital flyers, and polite hellos, something festered. Then came the tapes. There were three, all found at the crime scene, each labeled for a daughter, each recorded on a different day. One of them included something new. A voice. A second voice. It wasn't one of the children. It was a woman. Faint. Muffled. Crying. I took the audio to a forensic analyst I'd worked with before. She boosted the background. And beneath the whispering, beneath the lullaby, we heard a phrase. You don't have to do this. It was Eleanor. Travis had recorded a conversation, secretly, weeks before the murders. In it, his ex-wife was trying to reason with him. Just let me take them. You need help, Travis. They don't need your kind of help, he replies coldly. You think the system's against you? You think you're a victim? Pause. I'm not a victim, Travis says. I'm a corrector. A corrector. That single word shifted the investigation. He didn't see this as violence. He saw it as course correction, as if the depths of crime he committed were justice tales. That's when I realized we were dealing with someone who didn't want to escape justice. He wanted to redefine it. A week later, a tip came in from a trucker in northern Idaho. Said he saw a man fitting Travis's description at a rest stop near Coeur d'Alene. Thin sunglasses, flannel shirt. The man was talking to himself. He bought 3 granola bars. When he left, he tossed something into the trash. The marshals pulled the bin. Inside, a torn photograph. The girls smiling. Behind them, the piano. But something else was written on the back. Memory is a liar. But sound is truth. I couldn't sleep that night. I kept hearing that voice, his voice, saying, "Daddy's going to fix everything." And I realized something even more terrifying. He never planned to disappear forever. He wanted to be found, on his terms, in his own time, with his own rules. The closer I got to the truth, the more invisible Travis Decker became. Every breadcrumb led somewhere. But each trail ended in smoke. After the sighting in Idaho, the case picked up momentum. The U.S. Marshals Service joined the manhunt. Travis's face flooded digital billboards across Washington and Idaho, wanted for the murder of his 3 daughters. $20,000 reward. But by the time the public got involved, Travis had already erased his footprints. And then came the real breakthrough. I got access to a financial disclosure form, sealed in the divorce proceedings and previously buried under red tape. His ex-wife had flagged unusual asset transfers and unauthorized offshore withdrawals. At the time, the court dismissed it as a civil matter, just another casualty of bureaucracy. But I knew better. Travis was running shell games years before the murders. He'd created at least 5 ghost companies, all variations of names with musical or historical connotations. Claire Systems LLC, Orfeo Holdings, Carver's Estate, Minuet Financial, Lullaby Trusts Incorporated. The registered addresses were empty storefronts. The EINs were real, but the businesses were fabrications. What wasn't fabricated? The money. Roughly $2.3 million moved through those accounts over a span of 4 years. Not illegal on the surface, but when traced, it exposed a pattern of wealth shielding and high-level financial corruption. He wasn't just a killer. He was an architect of financial crime. And the most haunting part? No one had noticed. Because on paper, Travis was clean. Too clean. I kept digging. One early morning, while combing through a mirrored backup of one of the shell companies, I found a corrupted document titled Piano Sonata, Final Arrangement. It was an Excel file, but it wasn't a composition. It was a timetable. March 2nd, sedatives. March 8th, file transfers. March 10th, car sale. March 14th, flight reserve fallback. March 15th, final arrangement. I sat there, staring. The level of perfection in detailing, the cold, calculated breakdown, left me numb. Travis had literally composed his daughter's deaths like a musical piece. Every line a movement, every action a note in a symphony of control. And I was just beginning to understand the depth of it. I needed someone who could interpret these financial maneuvers better than I could. So I went to Eli Santos, a former fraud investigator turned whistleblower. He'd worked with the FBI's forensic accounting division before walking away from what he called the rot beneath the ledger. When I showed him the transfers and aliases, his jaw tightened. "This isn't some lone guy trying to hide money," he said. "This is someone who learned from watching real criminals." "How real?" I asked. "Cartel real. High net worth evasion real. Travis studied this. So he's not just a CPA." "No, he's a student of the hidden world." That stuck with me. Because if Travis had learned how to vanish financially, maybe he learned how to vanish physically too. Days later, I got an anonymous email. Subject line: "You're getting too close to his melody." Attached was a single file, a still frame from a surveillance video. A man lean tall, wearing a hoodie, standing inside a gas station off Route 93 near Missoula, Montana. The timestamp, 2 days ago. His face was blurry, but the posture was unmistakable. He was standing at the register, holding a folded map and a cassette tape. Behind him, through the reflection in the window, something else caught my eye, a child's backpack. Blue. Cartoon characters. A girl's backpack. I froze. I zoomed in. It looked new. I called the authorities. They were skeptical. Could be old. Could be nothing. But something told me this was a thread in the unraveling story. Travis didn't leave anything behind unless it was meant to be found. The next clue came from the unlikeliest of places, a piano repair shop in Butte, Montana. The owner reached out after seeing my podcast. He said a man came in last week, asking to tune a vintage upright he'd recently inherited. Paid in cash. Said he was opening a children's music program, off-grid. The description? Quiet. Polite. Hands like a pianist. He left behind a small bag. Inside, a torn music sheet with blood on the corner. The piece? A custom composition titled, March of the Forgotten. I ran it through music recognition software. It didn't exist in any database. He had written it himself. Another note in the symphony. Another breadcrumb in the mind of a man trying to tell a story through crime. A chilling narrative. A thrilling narrative. A true crime story with crescendos of death and silence. At this point, I wasn't just documenting Travis Decker. I was interpreting him. His crimes were notes. His money movements, rhythms. His murders, the final act of a lifelong performance played for an audience of one. And somehow, I'd become the encore. By the time I reached chapter 4 of Travis Decker's story, I realized I wasn't chasing a killer anymore. I was chasing a composer. Not of music, of meaning. Travis wasn't just trying to disappear. He was building a narrative of his own. A carefully layered crime story, coded in piano chords and bank statements. And I was starting to hear the melody. It began with the cassette tape I found on my windshield. I'd just finished recording an episode of Unveiled. It was after midnight. Rain tapped the hood of my car like a metronome. When I opened the driver's side door, I saw it, wedged under the wiper. Labeled in shaky red ink. Lullaby number 0 draft. I froze. It wasn't official evidence. The police hadn't released it. No one outside the investigation should have had access to the tapes. Which meant one thing. Travis was watching me. I played it the next morning under supervised audio conditions. It wasn't a lullaby. Not in the traditional sense. It was a message. The tape began with static. Then faint breathing. Then music. Simple, childlike. The notes stuttering like a toy piano left in the rain. Then his voice. You tell stories, don't you, Marissa? You dig. You frame. You edit. So do I. We're not so different. Except I don't lie to my audience. You think I'm a monster. But monsters are chaotic. I'm precise. I gave them peace. I removed them from a world that teaches them how to hate themselves. I kept them pure. Before the state could break them. You chase the truth. But truth doesn't come in interviews or courtrooms. It lives in the pauses. In the breath between notes. Click. That was it. No scream. No signature. Just a truth bomb dropped in a lullaby key. The FBI took the tape for analysis. But they didn't know what to do with it. I did. I layered it against the timeline. The song, the speech, the background noise. There were birds, nightjars, specific to a region in eastern Montana. And faintly in the background, a church bell. I traced it. One church in that area had bells recorded with a similar cadence. A decommissioned seminary near the town of Forsyth. I drove there the next day. The seminary was abandoned. Barred windows, vines curling around rusted gutters. But there were signs of life. A tin can fire pit. A tattered sleeping bag. Inside, I found a room once used as a music classroom. Dust-covered desks. A piano missing keys. And in the corner, a cassette deck. Still warm. There was no sign of Travis. But he'd been there. And he wanted me to know it. On the blackboard behind the piano was a single sentence, written in white chalk. Every note must resolve. It was a code. Another breadcrumb. He was teasing me. Telling me I was close. That his investigation narrative, his version of the story, had a planned ending. And I wasn't just following it. I was now part of it. That night, I revisited a detail I hadn't fully explored, Eleanor, their mother. We hadn't spoken since the murders. Her voice had appeared briefly on one of the cassettes, pleading for her children's safety. But she had gone silent since then. Some said she was grieving. Others said she was scared. I found her outside of Helena, Montana, living under a pseudonym. She agreed to speak, off-record but raw. He said he was building something, she told me. A place. A new way to raise them. He called it Carver's World. Like a sanctuary. He kept using that name, over and over. Said the system couldn't reach them there. I asked her if she thought Travis was insane. She paused. No, she said. That's the problem. If he were insane, he'd be easier to find. Travis believes in his own version of justice. He thinks he's saving them. Still. Even after their deaths. Even now. She handed me one last thing. A flash drive Travis had sent her a week before the murders. She hadn't had the courage to open it. I did. Inside were audio files labeled simply. Movement I, trust. Movement 2, obedience. Movement 3, silence. Finale, shadows. Each was a piano piece. But laced underneath the music were distorted vocal clips. Snippets of courtroom proceedings, child welfare interviews, even podcast clips from Unveiled. He was sampling the bureaucracy he hated, and burying it beneath harmony. This wasn't about escaping. It was about rewriting. He wasn't hiding from the world. He was composing a world of his own. And the scariest part? He believed it was beautiful. You don't expect a killer to have fans. But in today's world, even the most sinister cases attract believers. And by the time the FBI started referring to Travis Decker's file as Open Drift, I knew we weren't dealing with a one-man operation anymore. We were dealing with a movement. It began with a message posted on a dark web forum titled Nature's Secrets, a minimalist site built for survivalists and off-grid thinkers. The admin had locked the threads after a warning from Homeland Security, but cache screenshots were still floating around. One thread stood out. He was right. The state broke us. He spared them. Claire de Lune is the key. At first, I thought it was metaphorical. Then I noticed something. In several survivalist channels across Telegram and encrypted Discord servers, people were using musical terminology as code. Sonata protocol equals vanish completely. The final arrangement equals death before capture. Resolve the note equals silence witnesses. It was all built around the Decker mythos. And it wasn't just digital. I received an anonymous package at my hotel in Missoula. Inside, a folded map, a harmonica, and a note. Harmony is stronger in isolation. He's safe. We keep him safe. Stop unraveling. They weren't just hiding him. They were protecting him. That's when I met Cole. He was 27. Former Coast Guard. Clean cut. Bookish. And formerly part of a backwoods militia that believed the U.S. government was running emotional compliance operations through public schools and child welfare agencies. He agreed to talk. On the record. One condition. I couldn't tell the feds where. They think he's just a murderer, he said. But he's an architect. He cracked the code. What code? I asked. The code of interference. Every time a parent disciplines a child, they risk the state taking over. CPS, courts, psychologists. It's all designed to fracture the family. Travis reversed that. By killing his daughters? He leaned in. By preserving them. He gave them peace before the state could poison them. I stared at him. He wasn't joking. He wasn't unstable. He believed. And it hit me. Travis Decker wasn't just a fugitive. He had become a symbol, a mythologized figure for people desperate for control in a world spinning too fast. Then came the biggest break of all. A woman in Kalispell, Eliza Green, a former schoolteacher, contacted me. She said a man had been renting a trailer on her late uncle's rural property for over a year under the name Andrew B. He claimed to be recovering from trauma and paid in cash. He was quiet, polite, and played piano late at night through the open windows. He left a week ago, but she kept something. A diary. Not his. Her own. She'd been writing about his habits. Page 14 stopped me cold. Last Thursday, I heard him singing. Just a single line. Over and over. I love you more than they'll ever understand. My stomach flipped. That was the same line from Grace's tape. It was him. Travis Decker had been living undetected, one state over, protected by silence, money, and belief. Eliza also found a music box in the shed behind the trailer. When opened, it played a warped version of Claire de Lune. But inside the mechanism was hidden a microSD card. On it, surveillance footage. From my apartment. My hallway. My building lobby. Me coming and going. Reading mail. Eating lunch. Recording. He'd been watching me. Just as I'd been watching him. I turned it over to authorities, of course. They launched an internal investigation. But the fear was already inside me. And that's the thing no one tells you about true crime stories. The line between observer and participant is razor thin. One day you're chronicling a case. The next, you're written into the plot. The marshals moved in on the Kalispell trailer. But it was empty. Wiped clean. Even the power meter had been pulled. All that remained was a single file on a thumb drive left in the kitchen drawer. Titled, Finale Draft 1.mp3. A piano piece. Slow. Measured. Flawless. And at the end, his voice. You came close, but not close enough. A sharp mind can follow notes, but only a broken heart can understand the silence between them. And then, I forgive you. That was the end. Or so I thought. There's a kind of silence that doesn't come from the absence of sound. It comes from knowing that some stories will never resolve. I sat in the dark that night, microphone off, computer screen glowing faintly. The thumb drive still in my palm. I forgive you. That voice. Cold. Patient. Almost paternal. That was the last thing Travis Decker ever said to me. And in that moment, I realized something I hadn't allowed myself to admit. Not once in 6 chapters of this case, not once in 12 months of tracking, unraveling, narrating. I had lost. Not to the law. To the narrative. Because this wasn't a manhunt. It was a story. His story. And I'd been conscripted as the final act. The U.S. Marshals still have Travis Decker on their most wanted list. The reward remains at $20,000. His last confirmed sighting was in Butte, Montana, but leads now stretch as far as New Mexico and British Columbia. One anonymous caller claimed he'd seen Travis walking a little girl into a motel at dusk. Another swore he saw him working at a bookstore in Santa Fe. But nothing stuck. Nothing held up under scrutiny. Then, 2 months after the final tape, I received a small manila envelope. No return address. Inside, a photograph. The girls. All 3 of them. Hannah. Leah. Grace. Smiling. Alive. But the photo wasn't recent. It was taken years before. At a pumpkin patch. Fall leaves, orange sun matching scarves. On the back, scribbled in the same red ink. Memory lies. Love doesn't. I spent the next 3 weeks off-grid. I couldn't eat. Couldn't think. I kept replaying every decision. Every dead end, every episode, every clue I might have misunderstood. Every chilling secret I'd exposed and every detail I might have missed. Because that's what true crime does to you when you're too close. It rewires your brain. Turns you from journalist to addict. From observer to believer. And that was the worst part. I started to wonder if he was right. What if the world really is built on interference? What if the truth we seek is just a story told with better branding? What if Travis Decker saw something the rest of us refused to look at? What if, in his twisted mind, he believed he was the savior, not the suspect? Eventually, I turned my mic back on. I owed it to the girls. To Eleanor. To the truth. Even if it no longer looked like what I expected. So here I am. My name is Marissa Lane. And this is my final episode on the Travis Decker manhunt. There's no happy ending here. There's no closure. Just shadows. Shadows of justice. He never stood trial. Never answered for what he did. But he left behind something worse than silence. He left behind a story unfinished. And that's the thing about stories, especially in the true crime genre. They don't need to be solved to haunt you. They just need to be heard. To my listeners, thank you. For following every clue. For sharing every episode. For believing we could find the truth. Maybe someday someone will. Maybe someday the next page will turn. But until then, I'll leave you with this. In the world of unsettling narratives, Travis Decker didn't just disappear. He became the ghost in the story. And now, he's inside all of ours.